It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
When Sergeant Judd Green looks back at his 41-year-long career in law enforcement, one case in particular sticks out. The night of January 26th, 1988, was cold and suspiciously quiet at the Indianapolis Police Department. It was a night that Sergeant Green believed would be mostly characterized by coffee and small talk with his colleagues. But before long, Sergeant Green received a radio notification that would dramatically change the course of the night. A triple homicide more chilling than that 11-degree evening. I'm Emily Campagno, and this is the Fox True Crime Podcast. Kevin Connor was a cold-blooded killer. The night of January 26th, Kevin was drinking with three of his friends, Steve Wentland, Anthony Moore, and Bruce Vogue. Anthony, Steven, and Kevin had gone out for a drive, but tension in tight spaces turned deadly in an instant. Anthony attempted to escape the vehicle, but only to be run over by the two men remaining in the car. When that didn't kill him, Kevin got out of the car and stabbed him to death. Kevin and Steven then drove to a secondary location and argued over the murder. That fight ended in Kevin shooting and killing Steven. But Kevin's drunken rampage didn't end there. He returned to Anthony's home to find Bruce fast asleep. Kevin woke Bruce up before turning the shotgun on him as well. Kevin then fled to Texas to hide from his crimes, but only 2 days later, he was arrested by Texas Rangers. Sergeant Green flew down to Texas to bring him back to Indiana to answer for his crimes, but nothing could prepare him for Kevin Connor's chilling confession. Sergeant Green has detailed this case and many others in his book, Stories from the Streets. Today, he joins me to discuss these savage killings and why the murders by Kevin Connor still haunt him to this day. Detective, tell us a little bit, what drew you to law enforcement, and what was your career like?
Well, I grew up, I joined the Marine Corps, and, you know, you do a lot of things in the U.S., and then I went to Vietnam, and that was my first taste of adventure and excitement, and I just found it was an itch I needed to scratch. I really liked excitement. I really liked the dangerous part of it. I know that sounds crazy, but I just felt more alive. And when you're 19, you don't think you're going to be the one that gets it. You know, you think you're going to live forever. So, but I came back and I got out of the Marine Corps after 4 years, and I said to my dad, I got to find a job that offers me some excitement and venture. I didn't want to be a career Marine, but I had a friend who was a police officer, and he talked to me, said, well, why don't you become a cop? And we never had any police officers in our family, but I thought, well, that sounds like an exciting job. So I put in for it. I got selected and went through the academy, became a police officer, and did everything that, you know, the normal street cop does. I rode in a marked car and stopped traffic violators. I responded to runs and so forth. And then they had some specialties on the department. The first one, they were going to start a scuba team. And I'd been a competitive swimmer when I was a young guy. And so I was real comfortable in the water and put in for that. And I became a scuba diver, and And we recovered, of course, unfortunately, drowning victims, but we also recovered safes and guns and cars and, in one instance, an airplane. So,
oh, wow.
I like that. And I thought that was interesting work, and it was not something that everybody did. Our police department had about 1,100 officers, and there were only 10 of us divers. So we were kept pretty busy with that, and I enjoyed that. And then later on, about 8 years after that, we had a hostage situation here in Indianapolis. And it was the Tony Carissa situation, where Carissa walked into a mortgage company in downtown Indianapolis and wired a shotgun to the neck of a man named Richard Hall, and then pulled him out on the street and was walking down the street. We're all following him, and he actually stole a police car and then went out and held Mr. Hall hostage for about 2.5-3 days. And with that shotgun strapped to his neck. And that was many years ago. And it was international news. He had live TV of him holding the hostage with the shotgun. But we didn't have a hostage negotiations unit. So the chief told one of our lieutenants, he said, you know, we had to fly a negotiator, an FBI negotiator, into Indianapolis to help us with this. And we're not going to do that again. I want to train officers to be hostage crisis negotiators. So that was the birth of our team. There was a rule you couldn't be on two specialty call-up teams like scuba and negotiators. So I thought being a negotiator was something that fit me better. And so that's what I did. And then as one does, you advance through different ranks on the police department. I was promoted to sergeant. And then they wanted a guy that fit my physical description and so forth to do some infiltration motorcycle gangs. And so I did that. I grew a beard, long hair, ponytail, and so forth, and got biker clothes. And I worked undercover on and off for a number of years. And one of the stories I relate in my book that I wrote. But at any rate, I had a great career. I spent 32 years on Indianapolis PD. I retired and went to work as a detective sergeant on a sheriff's office here locally, and then was appointed chief of police of a small town just south of Indianapolis, and was there for 6 years, came back to the sheriff's office for a couple of years. And, you know, then, Emily, the tread was getting worn off my tires. I'm an old guy, and at some point in time, you got to quit being a police officer. You're just too old to do that kind of work. And I decided it was time to retire. I talked to my wife, and I left law enforcement about 23 years ago. So made a lot of friends. I think I made a difference. It was a job I was born to do, be a Marine and be a police officer. And God let me be both of them, and I'm thankful for that. So I had a great career, met a lot of wonderful people, and now I'm talking to Emily Campagno. I can't believe it.
Well, believe me, sir, the honor is all mine. You had an incredible career. You are continuing to thrive. Now you're an author, and you sound young and spry to me, so there's plenty ahead for you. So can you confirm for me, really quickly before we dive in, it's my understanding that the Kevin Connor case, that took place in Clark County, because I thought that was the prosecuting body was Clark County. But were you a detective with Marion County when that happened? And I apologize for that. I'm just trying to wrap my brain around the geography and the jurisdiction.
That's okay. It was a change of venue. And so the murders happened in Marion County. I was an Indianapolis police detective, sergeant at that time. They actually happened inside the city of Indianapolis. So IPD was assigned the case, and myself and my partner at the time, Ed Stamm, we worked cases, you know, multiple murders in teams. So Ed and I got assigned that case. And so then when we got Connor, we apprehended him, arrested him. Then his lawyers asked for a change of venue. The two prosecutors who are listed as the Clark County prosecutors are actually Marion County, or were actually Marion County deputy prosecutors. And when the change of venue was approved by the judge, they'd been handling the case up to that point, and they just moved to Clark County and prosecuted it there.
We're going to take a quick break. More from our guest after this.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
So let's go back then to the beginning of the case, which occurred on January 26th, 1988.
Right.
Tell us where you were that night and when you first learned about what became a triple homicide.
Okay, well, I was coming into work, and we work in late shift, 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. Ed Stamm, my partner, Detective Stamm, was on the tax shift, so he worked 7 p.m. to 3 a.m. And it was a really cold night. I mean, bitter cold. And so I came in the office, said hi to Ed, and we poured a couple cups of coffee, and I said, "What's going on?" And he said, "Really, it's been pretty quiet, you know." And I spoke words I should have never spoken, which was, "Yeah, it'll probably stay that way." So right after that, the dispatcher put out a run. We were listening to our radios, and it put out a run to a man hit by a car on the south side. Well, that doesn't concern us unless it's purposeful. So the uniform guys went down there and they found this guy. Said, "Yes, he's been hit by a car, and it's pretty critical condition." And so we looked at each other and said, "Well, it's not going to be anything for us to do." And then they said, "Well, would you send homicide, because he's also been stabbed several times?" So, and the cars left the scene. We have witnesses say they purposely ran over him. So Ed and I both jumped up, and he said, "Look, I'll take it. And you stay here in the office, because I may ask you to coordinate things either at the hospital or..." I said, "Okay." So he went out there, and on the way out there, I heard on my radio, they said the subject is deceased. And so Ed went out there, and then a chain of events started, and we found out that this victim had jumped out of a car, which two other young men were in. And one of the men jumped out of that car after they ran him down and stabbed him to death, and then they drove away. So we knew the three men were connected somehow. And as it evolved, we ended up having three crime scenes, three dead bodies. And we just kept finding bodies. And one of them, the body was taken out on the interstate west of Indianapolis and was dumped there in a kind of a park setting. State police found that body the next day. And they called us and said, "Are you guys missing a body?" I said, "Yeah, we got a crime scene, but no body. We got a lot of blood." And so we ended up finding that there were three victims. And they were together earlier, and they were, one of them stayed where they were drinking at this guy's house and said, "I'm going to sleep on the couch." And he did. That was Vogue. And so then they went out to pick up more booze, I think, and got an argument inside the car. And the one guy jumped out and took off, and then he ran him down. Then the driver jumped out, stabbed him. And then there were two of them. So they went to another place and started talking about the murder. And we don't know what happened because the conversation between them, we didn't hear that. But the Connor, Kevin Connor, decided, "Well, you know, I've already killed that one guy, and I might as well kill this guy." So he shot that guy with a shotgun. Then Connor thought, "Well, there's one left alive. He's at this guy's house sleeping on the couch. I better go kill him." So he went and killed him. And then he jumped a bus to, he was going to flee to California. And Ed and I found out about that. So we called the Texas authorities and said, "This bus is supposed to come through Amarillo. we're going to fax you a picture of this guy, and we're also going to get warrants for him for murder. So be cautious. He's already killed three people. So about a day later, they called us and said, we got him. And so we flew down in the governor's plane. We brought Connor back, Mirandized him, and he gave us a full confession. It was amazing. He wasn't remorseful at all. In fact, he laughed a little bit. So we were able to get a confession from him, and then he was charged with three counts of murder, and he was convicted. He was sentenced to death, and he went to Indiana State Prison. And finally he said, you know, I'm done with the appeals. Let's get the killing over with. And so it was a couple of days before he was to be executed. He said, you know, I need to tell you about another guy I killed. He told the prison staff that. He said, I killed a fellow inmate on death row. I knifed him to death in the yard when we were exercising. And that case was unsolved, of course. And so now they knew somebody in the prison had done it, but they didn't know who did it. But Connor said, well, I killed the guy. He didn't say what for. And then Connor was put to death, and he didn't show any remorse up to the moment they stuck a needle in his arm.
Interestingly, on the subject of remorse by Kevin Connor, or the lack thereof, in the case files, it lists as a mitigating circumstance that there is genuine remorse. And yet, as you've expressed, you certainly never encountered any of it, including during the confession. And Tony Moore's sister, Diana Beaver, said that Connor has never shown remorse.
Right.
So I was wondering if you could share a little bit more about the confession.
I can. Remorse can take a couple different paths, Emily. One can be, I'm truly sorry for what I did, and I'm sorry that I harmed these people or took their lives. And the other one is, gee, I'm sorry I got caught.
Yeah.
And when Detective Stamm and I went in the room, we knew this was going to be a death penalty case. And Ed, same way I am. He's a straight shooter. We're not going to trick this guy. We're not going to mistreat him. We're just going to go in and talk to him and Mirandize him before we do. And we did. And so I said, You want to tell us about what happened, your side of the story, because three other people can't tell us their side. So we want to hear your side. And he said, yeah, he said, I killed him. And we kept waiting for the why. And he never really had a why. We asked him, was there something that set you off, or why did you do this? And he said, I just, you know, I felt like I had to do it. And then I killed one. I figured, well, I better kill the other two. And he was so nonchalant about it, I gave him the nickname of the Iceman. Mm. And we came out of that questioning room, and Ed Stamm, like me, is a veteran detective. And I had just celebrated 20 years on the police department then. And I looked at Ed, and he looked at me. We both said, wow, never had a guy like that in a room that was that cavalier about killing three people. So I personally did not see any remorse, Emily.
Can you share about him as a suspect that night, maybe compare and contrast with other confessions that you've taken throughout your career? Was he particularly memorable to you? And if so, for what reasons?
One thing that I studied and then lectured about for many years was body language. And I had students over in the university that were criminal justice students. And I said, you have to learn to read people, particularly out on the street. It'll save your life. But where that really comes to fruition is in the, they don't say interrogation room anymore. They say interview room. But when you have a suspect in there, you have to be aware if the suspect is telling you the truth or if they're lying. And the majority of time, they're probably going to lie about something. And the body communicates leakage through body language. And so I taught this stuff, you know, so I was aware that when we went in there, I told Ed, I said, you know, you do the questioning. I want to watch him, and I want to see if he, you know, the eyes are the windows to the soul. I want to see if his eyes dilate. I want to see if he shows any other signs of stress, covering his mouth to try to keep the words in he's saying, crossing his legs, crossing his arms, blinking, looking up to the left or right, perspiration on the upper lip or above the eyebrows, all kinds of things that can indicate stress. They don't, any one of them indicate lying, but if you see several of them together, based on the question that's asked, it can be that the man is not telling the truth. So we went into the interview room assuming that he wouldn't tell us, that he would probably lie or try to mitigate what he'd done. Well, I did it because the one guy tried to kill me or something like that. And there was none of that. I mean, not anything. He was hungry because we'd flown back from Texas. He said, could I get something to eat? I said, sure. So we got him a hamburger and a Coke, and then we went outside, let him alone eat, and kind of let stress build. And then we went in there and told him, you know, we'd like to talk to you about what happened. He said, yeah, I'm ready to talk to you. And we had signed a Miranda waiver before we left Texas. But I told him not to say anything in the plane because it was the governor's plane. It was a little two-engine deal. And it was really loud, and I didn't want to miss saying it. I said, Kevin, don't say anything until we get back to our office. He said, okay. And I mean, we got back to our office. He ate his hamburger. We walked back in the questioning room. I said, do you care if I turn a tape recorder on? He said, no. I gave him Miranda rights again. He said, is this the same form I signed in Texas? I said, yes, it is, but you need to read it. And I'm going to read it to you. And I did. He signed it. I said, do you mind if I audio record this? He said, not at all. And we had a videotape going up in the corner. And I said just what I told you. I said, you know, we can't hear the other three sides of what happened. We can only hear yours. So tell us what happened. How did all this begin? And he was relating how it happened. He never told us why. And he laughed a couple of times when he was talking about different things that happened. And one of them was when he went back to the house where Vogue was sleeping on the couch. In fact, I think it was Ed that asked him this. He said, well, Kevin, did you shoot him while he was sleeping? And Connor started laughing. He said, no. He said, I wouldn't do that. I'm not that kind of guy. He said, I woke him up so he could see it coming. Well, you know, I thought that was a pretty cold thing for him to say, and certainly not something you would laugh while you were saying. And so that's why I say I didn't see any remorse, and he was just the Iceman.
I mean, it's so difficult to even hear that someone was that cavalier or seemingly unaffected about such violent homicides. And three of them. Can you describe your thoughts on that and reactions on the violence and sort of horror of each of these three different homicide scenes?
Oh, Ed and I were veteran homicide detectives. So, I mean, we'd been to many, many homicide scenes and investigated many homicide scenes. But, you know, you're not born a cop. You just become a cop. And granted, you get hardened to things. But every person's murder is unique and important because it was a life that was, in my opinion, granted by God and put on this earth. And I don't think God ever made a person in love. It's that he gave us free will to choose to make decisions that caused our lives to take different directions. And so I still hated to see families that were destroyed by their sons and daughters being murdered. I saw a lot of that. It did too. But I'm telling you, Emily, when this guy was as cavalier as he was about killing these three people, it was just bizarre. It was. And man, I don't know. I can't compute why he was that way. I just can't. I don't know. I know he had a rough childhood, but not too rough. His dad didn't beat him to death or anything. But, you know, I just thought, wow, this is a guy who doesn't have a conscience. And he didn't, as far as I'm concerned.
And I think what struck me about reading the facts of this case, in addition to it just being horrific, is the effort it took for him to go to each of his friends' locations. It took extreme effort because, you know, part of, again, the mitigating circumstances that was listed included intoxication, for example, but that sort of implies or frankly, under the law, it almost excuses accountability for one's actions. And that's supposed to explain like a very sudden behavior. But this struck me as very calculating and cold to run a man down and then to stab him and then to go seek out the other two. It seemed incredibly purposeful and that it took a lot of effort. What did the community say and feel about this triple homicide and about Kevin Connor?
Well, let me comment first on what you just said. When I was teaching classes over at the college, I would look up a lot of quotes by famous people, and you had just reminded me of a quote by Ralph Waldo Emerson. We were talking about why this guy, you know, didn't show any emotion and he was cold. And I got to tell you, when I walked out of the room, my thought process, I didn't say it did, but my thought process was, I have just looked at pure evil. Mm. And I remember the quote from Emerson, who said, there's a capacity of virtue in us, and there's a capacity of vice to make your blood creep. And that wasn't the normal Emerson quote you got, but it was so revealing to me that that Mr. Emerson understood people very well, and he understood evil. Make your blood creep. And yeah, he made my blood creep for sure. And so that's, I guess, the way I would answer your question.
We'll be right back with more of this story. One of his attorneys, a quote that she made really struck me. She said, I think he's a bright, talented kid who's paying for a hell of a night. He's easy to work with, very appreciative. I will miss him. It's hard for me to fathom anyone describing a triple homicide in such violent fashion, in such a calculated demeanor, as a, quote, hell of a night. I wonder how the community responded to this and what the community thought of Kevin Connor.
Well, you know, that attorney knew him in another venue. I mean, he knew him in a setting where he sat down with him. How you doing, Mr. Connor? Hey, sir, how are you? And he was polite. He didn't have a shotgun pointed at the guy. And, you know, the attorney made a judgment based on his impression of Kevin Connor. I don't think that's right. I mean, I just think that it's a better world without Kevin Connor, because he's already ruined three families' lives. And he took away three young men, everything that they had and everything they ever would have. And he can't give it back. And he's not sorry for it. So I think the exact place for that guy is on death row with a death sentence, and take him out of our society. And so I don't agree with what that attorney said. I understand that he saw Connor in a different light than the rest of us did, but I don't go with that. I'm sorry. I don't believe it.
Yeah. And I can't imagine describing that as a hell of a night. I mean, it's a pretty callous statement to make.
It is very callous. And you see some of these attorneys who represent people in court who've done horrible, horrible things, you know, even to kids. And they'll say, well, you know, this guy really down deep isn't a bad guy. I'm thinking, you're crazy. He's not only bad, he's evil. And some people, I don't think, need to live among us, because I don't think they can. And I think that's evil personified in a human being. So I'm glad the guy's gone. I'm glad he was executed. I'm sorry for his family, of course, because they didn't do anything. But I'm really sorry for the other three families that lost three sons. And that was forever.
You described how you obtained Connor, you apprehended him in Texas. And the day after the judge sentenced him to death, he jumped a wall and escaped from the county jail, ran for about 3 minutes before being recaptured. And then in 1994, he and four other others on death row used hacksaw blades, makeshift knives, and a grappling hook in an attempt to escape. He and those and three of the four made it to the base of the outside wall before being spotted and captured. What do these attempts and fleas, what does that tell you? What are your thoughts on those?
Well, it makes me think, gee, I wonder who the unfortunate people would have been who ran into those guys first when they were trying to complete their getaway, you know, either carjacking a car, breaking in a home, stealing a car. I mean, I know what they would have done. What do they have to lose? They're on death row, you know, or they've been sentenced to death. When I went through homicide school, I had a very wise instructor. And he said, ladies and gentlemen, we had probably 40 homicide detectives there. And he said, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to remember two things. It isn't about just catching people. It's about catching the right people. Because he said, here's what happens if you just clear cases. You make an arrest, and you're not 100% positive where this guy did it, but you want to clear that case. You want to say, yeah, Captain, I got that guy, and he goes to get convicted, goes to prison, and he's not the right guy. There's two things that happen. First of all, the horrible circumstance of being convicted of a crime you didn't commit, and maybe being executed for it. But that's not as bad as something else you've unleashed, and that is the true killer, the real killer, is still out there among us. And he has already crossed, or she has already crossed a line that you can't cross, and that's taking a human life. So how many times can we execute this guy? Well, once. So since he's already killed somebody, and you've got somebody else in prison, you have unleashed his evil among us again, and he's more likely to kill another person. So he said, ladies and gentlemen, he said, make sure on these cases, because you're standing in people's shoes, can't stand their own shoes anymore, and it's your responsibility to do it right no matter what. And I never forgot that. And so I wasn't just out to make arrest for murder. I was out to get the right person to get him out of our society so he couldn't hurt anybody else.
It struck me that this case seemed to move relatively fast. Maybe it was a reflection of the times, but the homicides occurred on January 26th, and he was had already been convicted and was sentenced on November 3rd of the same year. My question is, he received death sentences for two of the murders, for Moore and Vogue, but 60 years for the murder of Wendland. Can you describe why he didn't receive the death penalty for that one?
I'm not sure the judge reasoning on that. I mean, yet two death penalties, it's like getting 10 or one. I mean, you can only execute this guy one time. I'm not sure the judge's reasoning for that. I don't know. As to the speed with which this case was concluded, I thought it was pretty fast. So did Ed.
Yeah.
And I think that we heard that Connor had said, I just want to get this over with. Well, at the end of, you know, the report that I sent you, he said, Connor said, you know, well, let's get on with the killing, as they were walking him to the death chamber. And so he was still cavalier, even about his own life. So I'm glad it went that fast. I wish they all did, as long as we could be sure we had the right people. But I don't know. Can we ever? I mean, you know, you read about guys who get out of prison. My wife and I watched Chill last night, where a guy was in prison for 12 years for a murder, and then the Innocence Project proved he didn't do it. And then another guy came up and, you know, through DNA, and they said, you killed this person. He said, yes, I did. But all those years, he didn't come forward to get this guy out of prison. What if we'd executed him, you know? So you don't want to be cavalier about death or taking someone's life. But I think we have to remain a society that removes people like that, that will hurt us, hurt our children, hurt our parents, and hurt other members of our society. It just can't live without killing us. And so we have to take them out. And I guess that's a normal police attitude, Emily.
The only thing what I thought about was that, you know, Tony Moore had been the one that drove and ran over Steve Wendland. He ran him over before then Kevin Connor stabbed him to death. So I think for that shared responsibility of the death, perhaps that's the only thing that I could think about as a difference in as to why that wouldn't be a capital murder. And I'm not barred in Indiana, so I don't know for sure.
Well, I think you're wise for looking at it in that way, because it really didn't make any difference in the sentence. He was still going to be put to death. But if you're looking for a reason that the judge may have not given him death penalty, I think that's a good way to look at it. And I think it's probably true. When I wrote this book and I put that case in there, I thought about, you know, because I read a lot about writing. I'd never written a book before. And I ran across a gal, lady, who'd written 60 books, and she's a very famous author, Anais Nin. And she said, we write to taste life twice, in the moment and in retrospection. And it's a beautiful quote. I wish I'd said it. It's on the power of writing. And it does allow us to live life twice, to revisit those moments we have. This was one case I didn't enjoy doing. I mean, you know, I had some fun stuff in my book and funny things that happened to me and other officers, and had some difficult things in there. But this is one case that I struggled with where I was going to put it in my book or not. And I had to, because I thought it needed to be told.
You've had such a storied career in law enforcement, so varied, fascinating, impactful, important. What overall did this case teach you as a detective? So you're saying you don't like it. What did you learn from it, if anything? What was your takeaway?
My dad said, after I had about a year on the police department, I went over to my parents for dinner. And after dinner, we're having coffee. And my dad says, well, son, we've never had a policeman in the family before. How do you like it? And I said, I can't believe they paid me to do it. He said, well, son, you got the right job. And he said, anytime you can spend your life making a difference, a positive difference in other people's lives, you got the right job. And those are the kind of parents I had. I was very fortunate, you know. And so I look back on my career, and it wasn't a perfect career, Emily. I made mistakes. I made bad judgments. I gained a lot of experience, and they say you get experience by making mistakes. I guess you do. But all in all, I had a good career, safe career. I didn't get hurt too many times. And so I'm glad that I'm here with my wife and family now, my grandkids. And I hope I did make a difference. I think I did. But I'll tell you, it's what cops do every day. And the assault on police officers in this country, don't get me started on that, because, you know, who are you going to call if you can't call the cops? Who are you going to call? And there is nobody. We're it. The one thing about law enforcement I would end up telling you is that the reason I liked it so much is I knew that the officer working next to me would die for me, and I would die for him. Didn't care if it was male, female, black, or white. And the only other group of people that have that kind of commitment towards each other is the military. And nobody else in our society, you know, would a lawyer do one day of your sentence? No, never. Would you give back your money if you get convicted? No, he won't. But police officers who don't even know each other will die for each other, never knowing each other's names, because it's the commitment we make. And I'm proud to make that commitment. I was proud to be allowed to be a member of a group of people like that. And I still am. And I have a lot of great friends that been friends with for 60 years, you know, and we'll remain friends till we leave this earth.
Detective, thank you. Thank you for your service, most importantly, with the Marines and in law enforcement. And it's been incredible to hear your perspective today. And this case is just the tip of the iceberg, like I said, but I'm so grateful for your time sharing with us today. But above all, just most importantly, your service and that selfless sacrifice that you and your family has made. Can you share what the title is of your book and how listeners can buy it?
It's called Stories from the Streets, Drug Dealers, Hostages, and Killers. It's by me, Judd Green. It's on Amazon in paperback or ebook. It's about 53 chapters, almost. It's 490 some pages. But each of the chapters is a different story. So you could read chapter 1 and then chapter 59 or chapter 53 and then go back to read 25. So I wrote it so you could sit down and you could know what police officers do and let you peek under the tent a little bit. You know, it's kind of like everybody slowing down at an accident scene and they're looking over, they're rubbernecking and they're trying to get a look. So this allows you, my book would allow you some laughs out loud, probably a couple of tears for some children I helped. But it'll allow you to see some secret things that only police officers are allowed to see. And so I think people like that. They like to get an inner look at something that they don't normally, you know, be able to see. So that's how I tried to write the book, and I tried to write it to be entertaining. But you know what? I did it for what Anais Nin said. I did it because I wanted to taste life twice. I had already been involved in those events, and I wanted to think about the officers I was with, the victims I helped. And it did. So I was happy to write most of that book. Some of it was tough, but I liked it. Thank you for allowing me to give the title of it.
And then just before we close, do you have any final thoughts, any final message that you'd like to leave listeners with?
Gosh, I don't know. I'm not much of a philosopher, Emily. I think that the mark of a person is how you treat people that can never help you. My wife and I go out to dinner and servers come up to us and they wait on us and they make us feel important and they bring our food and so forth. And I remember going out to dinner with my mother and dad, and my dad, who was a retired Army colonel, he's kind of big deal when he was in the Army, but he treated people, whether they were mechanics or waiters and waitresses or anybody, the trash man. He would walk out and engage him in conversation, make sure he gave him a few dollars, you know, and he was just that way. And he taught me to be that way. But I think if you're not helping somebody that can't possibly help you in return, I think if you're doing that, you're a pretty good person. You got a good heart. And I would encourage you to do that.
I love this. Thank you, Detective. Thank you again for your time today and your perspective, which is so valuable, your insight into this really tragic case. And again, most importantly, your service. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you, Emily. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Please rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app. If you have a story or topic you want to hear on the show, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email at truecrimepodcast@fox.com.
The Will Cain Show is now dropping 5 episodes a week. Join Fox and Friends weekend host Will Cain as he tackles the latest headlines from his unique perspective, along with thought-provoking interviews with leading figures and live calls from viewers and listeners. Listen wherever you download your favorite podcasts.